Reveal is brought to you by Progressive, where customers who save by switching their home and car save nearly $800 on average. Quote at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $793 by new customers surveyed who save with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary.
From the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX, this is Reveal. I'm Al Edson. John Plueger, known as JP, cares a lot about words, where to put them, where not to put them, how to translate them.
So, otras noches te sueño de niño en el río.
Other nights I dream you are a child in the river by the cypresses.
Agua sobre las piedras, esa humedad bajo los árboles.
JP is a translator and poet from Houston, Texas. One day, early last year, a curator at the University of Houston's Art Museum got in touch with JP about this Spanish essay he needed translated into English.
And he asked me if I would be willing to do it, and I said yes.
The curator emailed JP the contract.
So I got home, printed it out, was reading through it, and I found the clause. It's clause number 33, no boycott. Contractor certifies and verifies that it, one, does not boycott Israel, and two, will not boycott Israel during the term of this agreement.
So under this clause, JP would not be allowed to do work for the university because JP has been boycotting an Israeli product for the past few years, Sabra Hummus. It's made by a company with ties to the Israeli military. And refusing to buy this hummus is JP's way of supporting a movement called BDS, which stands for Boycott, Divestment, Sanctions. BDS supporters see it as a way to use nonviolent protests to pressure the Israeli government about its treatment of the Palestinian people. Support for BDS has been growing here in the U.S. in recent years. Sitting at home, staring at this clause, JP had to figure out what to say to the curator.
I initially crossed out that clause and it put my initials next to it, scanned it, and sent it back to him. I think the next day told me that that wasn't a possibility, that I couldn't just cross it out, that I needed to either sign it or not sign it.
JP didn't sign and didn't get the job.
As a poet, I think very hard about how I put words together and what words I put out into the world and what those mean. And that was a definite combination of words that I was not willing to sign my name under.
This clause in JP's contract comes from a law that the state of Texas passed in 2017. A law that mandates that contractors who get money from the state agree that they will not boycott Israel. And it's not just Texas. Today, at least 17 states have laws or executive orders like the one JP ran into. All of this is happening at a moment when how Americans talk about Israel has become one of the most controversial questions in politics today. But no matter where you stand on the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, we're not here to talk about whether boycotting Israel is right or wrong. We're here to talk about the right to boycott itself. Because when JP saw the clause, JP was not just thinking about Israel.
So something like the First Amendment feels a little bit distant to me. But I definitely thought as I was reading it that I know that I have a right to hold my own beliefs, and this seemed like an infringement on that right.
Today on the show, we ask, who has the right to boycott and who doesn't? Reporter Julia Simon takes it from here.
If you want to understand the thinking behind Texas's anti-BDS law, a good place to start is in Washington, D.C., at the conference where some of the boycott movement's biggest critics gather every year.
It's Texas in the house. Everything is good in Texas. Hello, Texas. Yeehaw. Welcome to APAC.
This is APAC, the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, a group founded to represent the state of Israel in America. This year's conference started with a giant sing-along, thousands of people waving their hands back and forth.
Put your hands up!
After the music, the speeches started, and there was a theme.
I deeply oppose the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement. It is wrong to boycott Israel.
BDS is pure, unadulterated racism.
Even before Israel came into existence, boycotts were used as a weapon of those who opposed the very existence of the Jewish state.
That was New York Mayor Bill de Blasio, Vice President Mike Pence, Senator Jim Risch, and Senator Charles Schumer. Senator Schumer went on to explain that in his view, the current boycotts of Israel are part of a long history.
So from the moment Israel drew her first breath until this very moment, Israel has long been threatened by boycott movements. And I will always stand with Israel against those who seek to do her harm by boycott or by any other means.
Back in Texas, JP, the translator, does recognize the complexity of the issue.
How that gets sorted through and how people within Israel and Palestine decide to deal with that, you know, I don't know all of the answers there, but I do know that those specific claims of the BDS movement are important to me.
Important enough to do more than simply refusing to sign the contract. JP joined a lawsuit brought by the ACLU challenging the Texas law. Without knowing it, JP was joining a legal fight about the right to boycott that goes back to a tiny town in Mississippi during the civil rights movement.
Yes, we met in the movement, yes.
We were comrades in the struggle.
This is Carolyn and James Miller. They grew up in Port Gibson, Mississippi, met in the youth group of the NAACP.
What, 17?
Not when I was 17.
If I was, you're 4 years older than I am. What are you talking about?
As teenagers, Carolyn and James used to hang out at a local malt shop called Eddie Lee's. It was their spot. They would come, put a nickel in the jukebox, play some Curtis Mayfield, get a chili dog.
Famous hot dogs and malts.
Eddie Lee's was a safe haven for them. Even though the town was majority Black, most of the stores were white-owned and openly discriminated against Black people, especially the Piggly Wiggly supermarket. Carolyn remembers having to enter at the back of the store.
As a little kid, that's just the way I thought it was. I didn't even realize there was a front door.
Oh, yeah, that damn Piggly Wiggly. There were some rude white folks.
This is Charles Evers, brother of the famous civil rights leader, Medgar Evers, who was assassinated in the 60s. Charles is 96 now. After his brother was killed, he became the head of the Mississippi NAACP. In Port Gibson in 1966, everything was segregated, not just the stores. And besides voter drives and lawsuits, one of the main tactics the NAACP had to fight Jim Crow was boycotts.
Wherever Black folk were and not be treated, we boycott them. We slap a boycott on whatever store they chose that they felt like should be shut down.
So this was part of the movement?
Yes, It was a movement.
Charles Evers and the NAACP leadership wanted more job opportunities, an end to segregation, and just basic respect for the Black community. So they sent a letter to the local white leadership. When the white people didn't respond, the Black community began a boycott. So in Port Gibson, how successful was the boycott? Were most of the Black folk participating?
Oh, yes, indeed, yes. And then we began to open stores our own.
Black-owned businesses?
Yes.
Black people were going to places like Eddie Lee's, or even to neighboring towns for groceries, but not to white-owned stores, which started shutting down. And then the white businesses did something that the Black residents didn't expect. In 1969, the local hardware store, the Piggly Wiggly, and many of the white businesses sued the NAACP and more than 100 individual Black residents of the county.
Suing us for asking for basic courtesies? It made no sense to me.
That's Carolyn from the NAACP youth group. It didn't make sense to her husband, James, either. And a warning to listeners, there's an offensive term in this next part that some might not want to hear.
You know, how can you sue somebody because they don't spend their money at your store when you call them nigger?
And you don't give them any basic respect.
The white businesses were asking for millions of dollars lost from the boycott, and they wanted the boycott to stop. The case went to the Mississippi courts, and they sided with the white businesses. The NAACP appealed, and the case went on for 13 years. In 1982, they finally ended up here.
We'll hear arguments next in NAACP against Claiborne Hardware.
The Supreme Court of the United States.
Mr. Cutler, I think you may proceed whenever you're ready.
Attorney Lloyd Cutler stepped up. He was representing the NAACP.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court.
He started by going way back to the Boston Tea Party.
This nation was born out of a series of colonial boycotts against British merchants in support of petitions to the British King and Parliament for the redress of grievances.
He said the Founding Fathers loved boycotts.
And when they adopted the First Amendment, we submit, they could not possibly have intended to exclude from its protection the very means of petition that they themselves had employed.
Cutler argued that from the beginning, the founders were talking about using the power of the pocketbook to express political views and make change.
It is so wrapped into our history that we do not see how the First Amendment could be read to the contrary.
And the Supreme Court agreed. In an 8-0 decision, Thurgood Marshall recused himself because he used to represent the NAACP. The court said the right to peaceful boycott is protected by the First Amendment. The NAACP and the Black community of Port Gibson had won. Carolyn and James Miller helped organize a victory party. But not at Eddie Lee's.
Eddie's didn't have what we needed to go celebrate.
No.
They wanted something a little stronger than a malt.
It's been a long time, baby. We ain't doing malts no more. Now we're doing a little Jack, you know?
years later, Carolyn's now a first grade teacher. James works with juveniles in the justice system. And to be closer to their grandkids, they now live near Dallas, in Texas. I asked them if they'd heard of Texas's anti-boycott law. They haven't, so I tell them about the law and about JP.
Damn, that it's like an instant replay. It's like Port Gibson. It's the same thing that was happening in Port Gibson. I mean, how can that even be constitutional? I mean, come on.
Well, there are definitely people who do think it's constitutional.
I'm Eugene Kantorovich.
He's a professor of constitutional law
at George Mason University Scalia School of Law.
Eugene's Israeli-American. He also works for an Israeli think tank. And like a lot of people I met at the AIPAC conference, he sees the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement as discriminatory towards Israelis. So for the past few years, he's been working on a legal way to combat these boycotts. Eugene's actually been called the intellectual architect of America's anti-BDS laws because he's been helping elected officials all around the country make sure their laws pass a sort of free speech smell test.
I helped advise them on different paths to take, you know, a safe path to follow.
And what do you mean by safe?
It would be, you know, widely acceptable, doesn't raise any constitutional questions.
But as James Miller said, there are actually a lot of constitutional questions. And some of those questions go right back to Port Gibson, Mississippi, and the Supreme Court case, Claiborne Hardware versus NAACP.
First of all, Claiborne Hardware involved a consumer boycott. That's the example of you buying Sabra hummus. So none of the state laws involve consumer boycotts.
Eugene's saying all these recent anti-boycott laws around America, they don't affect consumers, they affect companies. And JP, the translator, Eugene says, is a company, a sole proprietorship, a one-person translation business. According to Eugene, JP can boycott Israel as a consumer till the cows come home. But if JP's one-person company boycotts Sabra Hummus, the state won't contract with that company.
In the capacity of his contractor as a state, he cannot boycott Israel. Now, in practice, a poet has a very limited ability, a translator has a very limited ability providing translation services to actually be boycotting Israel. So I would say this law has almost no application to him.
Well, he couldn't get paid.
He could get paid, because how, as a translator, is he boycotting Israel? There's a difference between personal and corporate capacity. What I can tell you is these laws do not apply to individuals. They apply to businesses.
That's not exactly right.
This is Brian House, one of the lawyers on the ACLU team representing JP. Brian says under Texas law and most state laws, JP the consumer versus JP the company, it's all the same.
The law says that there is no distinction between the sole proprietor as a business entity and the sole proprietor as an individual. So when a sole proprietor signs a form saying that as a contractor, they will not participate in boycotts of Israel, what they're certifying that is that neither as an individual nor as a business will they participate in a boycott of Israel at all for the duration of the contract. So I think this notion that you can cleanly separate a contractor's operations as a business entity versus as an individual, I don't think the law supports that.
Some states around the U.S. are now changing their anti-boycott laws so that they don't affect sole proprietorships like JP and only affect companies with more than 10 people. But Brian says that even then, those companies still have the right to boycott.
The Supreme Court has been extremely clear for several decades that businesses have the exact same First Amendment rights as individuals.
Brian and Eugene don't just disagree on the details of the laws, but on the very reason for being of laws that ban boycotts against Israel. Eugene sees these laws as a way to protect Israelis and Jews from discrimination. And he notes that BDS singles out Israel when it doesn't treat other nations the same way.
Why do people who say they care about human rights, why do they only target Israel? And it's a fair inference that this is a proxy for anti-Semitism.
Brian says, yes, anti-Semitism is a problem. And he says the government can make laws to curb some types of discrimination. For example, with public accommodation laws, the government can say to a hotel, you must rent rooms to Israeli people. You can't exclude them. But if individuals are boycotting Israeli-owned hotels as a means of political expression, Brian says the government can't police that. As the 1982 Claiborne Hardware case showed, the government can't take away the right to use boycotts as a means of political speech. And, Brian says, the government definitely can't single out one type of boycotting in its laws.
The fact that the government in these cases is only targeting boycotts of Israel and not even attempting to prevent discrimination in any other circumstance gives rise to a strong inference that the government's real interest is not in preventing discrimination, but rather in suppressing speech that it doesn't like.
A little over a week ago, a bipartisan group in the House introduced a resolution condemning the movement to boycott Israel. And back in January, the Senate overwhelmingly passed the Combating BDS Act, sponsored by Senator Marco Rubio. It's basically the federal government allowing the states to continue their anti-boycott laws. I asked several lawmakers, including Senator Rubio, to comment for this story. They all declined or didn't get back to me. But there is a video of Senator Rubio defending his bill on the Senate floor.
This doesn't in any way prevent anyone from participating in boycotting or divesting from Israel. All it says is that if you do, your clients in the form of state or local governments can boycott or divest you in return. Free speech is a two-way street.
But Dima Hedidi, a civil rights and liberties attorney, says free speech actually isn't a two-way street.
That misses the entire purpose of the First Amendment, which is to protect us against government interference in our First Amendment activities.
Dima's a cooperating attorney with the Center for Constitutional Rights and the director of Palestine Legal, an organization that tracks anti-BDS legislation. And she says people need to remember the First Amendment starts with Congress shall make no law. The Founding Fathers were saying the government isn't allowed to retaliate against speech it doesn't like. Because today, the government doesn't like speech against Israel. But what about tomorrow?
What will be next? If this boycott is unpalatable to our elected representatives, what is the next one that will be? You can imagine that they don't approve of a lot of boycotts and activism that happens. So that's really important to understand, that punishing one kind of boycott really affects all of our First Amendment rights.
As for JP, the translator in Texas, last fall, a university offered JP a teaching job.
I just waited to see the contract, and I got it, and it had the same language.
Another contract JP didn't sign, another job JP couldn't take.
I've definitely lost money already. I mean, I definitely am looking forward to the day that this law no longer exists and that I can go back to contracting not only with U of H, but also with other universities and other institutions around the state.
This past week, the ACLU attorneys went before a Texas judge for a hearing on the case to determine whether or not this anti-boycott law is constitutional. They're hoping to get a ruling soon.
Thanks to Julia Simon for that story. Brian House and the ACLU are also working on lawsuits challenging anti-boycott laws in Arizona and Arkansas. We should also mention that Brian is part of a team representing Reveal in an unrelated case. Julia's story was about laws that could restrict people from taking part in a boycott. But what do you do if you live someplace where it's nearly impossible to find a way around buying stuff from the people you want to boycott? That's next on Reveal from the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX.
Support for Reveal comes from Odoo. What is Odoo? Well, Odoo is an all-in-one management software with apps for every business need. Odoo has apps for CRM, accounting, sales, HR, inventory, manufacturing, and everything in between. And they're all in one easy-to-use software. And the best part about Odoo? All Odoo apps are integrated, helping you get things done faster and more efficiently. So when you think about business, think Odoo. To learn more, visit odoo.com/reveal. That's odoo.com/reveal.
This podcast is supported by Americans United for Separation of Church and State. Americans United defends your freedom to live as yourself and believe as you choose, so long as you don't harm others. Core freedoms like abortion rights, marriage equality, public education, and even democracy itself rest upon the wall of separation between church and state. A network of anti-democratic groups are attacking these freedoms, seeking to force us all to live by their narrow beliefs. Americans United is fighting back. Freedom without favor and equality without exception. Learn more about AU's work at au.org/MJ.
From the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX, this is Reveal. I'm Al Ledson. The idea of boycotting Israel didn't start in the United States. It started with Palestinians.
Our families, we always used to try to get the local stuff, vegetables, food, drink, whatever. So it's in our blood.
Samir Qureshi is a 35-year-old Palestinian entrepreneur. He says this idea he was raised on, boycotting Israel, is not an easy thing to do when you're living in a place like his hometown, Ramallah. It's a town of about 35,000 people in the occupied West Bank, which is controlled by both the Palestinian Authority and the Israeli military. Samir walks up the narrow sidewalks of Ramallah's steep hills towards a vegetable shop and greets the owner out front. He points to vegetables inside the store.
See it? Yeah. The cucumbers are Israeli. This is Israeli potato. The apple, you can see the logo, it's in Hebrew. The carrots are Israeli carrots, as you see. It's produced and packed in Israel.
Most of the produce in this small shop comes from Israel.
That's sad.
Sad, Samir says. Because when Palestinians buy Israeli-grown cucumbers to chop into their salads, they're supporting businesses that feed the economy of the Israeli state. In Samir's thinking, a military state, snipers, jeeps, an army of nearly 200,000 soldiers, forces that Samir sees in his everyday life, during military raids on his hometown or when he crosses a checkpoint to leave or enter Ramallah. He remembers the first time he encountered Israeli soldiers. He was just 5 years old.
Yes, actually, I was sleeping and the Israeli army broke into the house and then they took my father. Of course, naturally, I woke up because they were really loud. No one will forget such a horrible night.
Samir's father, a journalist, was arrested and imprisoned for half a year. And it wasn't just his father. Samir has watched his friends and relatives get detained by Israeli soldiers his whole life. And his whole life, he's been looking for the right way to take a stand. It wasn't until his 20s that he found it. And the idea came from an unlikely place. Producer Shayna Sheely takes us there.
It was a chilly spring night in 2012 in the Palestinian town of Jericho. Samir was at a party with some buddies.
We were at the backyard of a friend. There was a lot of almond trees around us and a few beers.
These were old friends, close friends. They hung out a lot.
Sometimes watching a movie, sometimes going for a hike.
And whenever they got together, the topic of conversation almost always turned to one thing: starting an entirely, purely Palestinian business.
Every idea crossed our mind, like opening a bar or even creating beer.
In their minds, giving Palestinians the option to buy homegrown products instead of Israeli ones would be a step towards self-sufficiency. Right now, a majority of Palestinian imports come from Israel, as do many resources like water and electricity. Samir and his friends wanted to do something to show independence from the Israeli economy.
And this one night, we were having a barbecue. A vegan friend of us, she just left like 10 centimeters for us to grill our meat. And we were like, yeah, you can't do that. With your vegetables, you just stuck everything on this grill.
And then she went on one of those vegan rants some of you might have heard before.
How healthy is this mushroom is, and the fiber and the protein in this mushroom. And she was explaining to us, and we listened to her, and we were fascinated by this idea of this creature, the mushroom.
When Samir saw that his vegan friend's mushrooms were from Israel, inspiration struck.
Then we decided that this is it. It's mushroom. Let's do mushroom.
Samir and his three friends decided they'd start the first Palestinian mushroom farm. Fine idea, except they didn't have a clue about this creature, the mushroom. Samir was in his late 20s. He had a good office job at a development NGO. But he threw himself wholeheartedly into this new idea.
Yes, I quit a good job to start a mushroom farm because I feel that I have to do it.
To help me understand why he would drop almost everything to get this business started, Samir tells me a story from his childhood. It was in the late 80s, around the same time his dad was arrested during the first Palestinian uprising, or Intifada, against the Israeli occupation. Palestinians collectively decided to boycott Israeli institutions, taxes, goods. They threw stones at Israeli delivery trucks and military tanks. There was a spark of revolution in the air. Samir was in a taxi with his family on their way to a wedding when a group of men wearing woven scarves called keffiyehs halted the car to a stop.
They asked the taxi driver, "What do you smoke?" And he said, "I smoke Times."
Times is an Israeli brand of cigarettes. The men continued with more questions.
"Don't you feel ashamed of yourself that you are smoking the cigarette of those who are arresting you and of those who are killing your sons and daughters, for those who claim that you do not exist?"
The men threw away the driver's pack and handed him a new one of Palestinian-made cigarettes.
These two strange masked men, they had an alternative in their hands.
Some 25 years later, Samir now saw himself as one of those keffiyeh-wearing guys. Instead of a cigarette alternative, he'd provide mushrooms. I meet Mahmoud Khail, one of Samir's partners, at the mushroom farm, off a dirt road with palm trees all around. He's wearing sweats and a V-neck, smoking a cigarette.
Good morning.
How are you?
Good, how are you?
About a year after that fateful barbecue, the guys found this piece of land in Jericho, the same town where they came up with the idea. They named the business Amoro Farms, from the Amorites, who lived on this land in ancient times.
and they taught themselves how to grow mushrooms.
I usually like to start the tour from outside.
Amoro Farms looks more like a row of white, double-wide trailers than a farm. Mushrooms are grown in insulated rooms, carefully controlled for humidity and temperature. Mahmoud unlatches a first door into a hallway, then a second into a small empty room, and a third into a dark sort of mushroom hall. All these separate entrances are to block outside air and to create a clean, sterile environment for the mushrooms.
It's so cool to be in this room. It's like a big mold room.
Yeah, definitely.
Mahmoud says the materials for growing mushrooms aren't available in the Palestinian territories. So, since they wanted to avoid Israeli goods, the mushroom guys imported stuff from all over the world.
Air condition, for example, comes from China. The exhaust fans, for example, to control the CO2 levels come from Spain. The electric comes from France, for example, Schneider and Germany.
Mahmoud shines a flashlight onto flat shelves of compost stacked like bunk beds. The shelves are completely covered with thready webs of white fungus.
I really like the shape of the mycelium. It's really trippy. It's like a spider net, but it's really, really, really white. And it goes into all directions. And it, you feel like it's infinite, that it's never ending.
In October 2014, about half a year after they bought the piece of land in Jericho, Samir, Mahmoud, and their partners harvested their first mushrooms and brought them to market. Samir says seeing the mushrooms on store shelves was like showing off his babies.
I'll never forget that day. I saw a mushroom in the shop and I really felt proud.
Within 2 months, mushrooms were flying off the shelves. Amoro sold 22 tons of mushrooms in the first year, then 25 tons in the second. They hired 12 pickers, all local women, and fans posted mushroom recipes on the Amoro Farms Facebook page. And then, in January 2016, an unexpected hitch. Their compost, which they'd been importing from the Netherlands, didn't arrive. The guys waited. And after a month, Samir hired a lawyer to go to the Israeli port of Ashdod, where goods from Europe come into the country. Israeli customs was holding the compost there, but the lawyer couldn't figure out exactly why.
There isn't any formal response of why our product is being delayed on the port.
Samir says the compost was held for 90 days before it was released. Their next shipment was delayed for 100 days, and the next for nearly 4 months. And for each day the compost was held, Amoro had to pay a fine to the Israeli port for storage. Samir still doesn't have answers about why the Israelis held his compost. I also tried to find out why they held up the shipments, but I didn't get much further. One possibility is an order from the Minister of Defense regarding certain materials like fertilizers that can be used to make explosives. Samir says he suspects the compost was held because authorities saw his business as a threat to the Israeli mushroom industry and wanted to shut Amoro down. Eventually, Amoro Farms ran out of money. They had to close their doors. Samir says he felt his heart break when he saw the empty mushroom hall.
It is one of the saddest images in my life, even much more than the bloodiest images. But like you're looking at an empty heart, like a skeleton.
Dozens of Palestinians wrote to him and posted on the Amoro Facebook page. Samir reads some of those messages.
Someone is asking, "I can't find your mushroom, we miss you." Someone wrote, "Good luck." And someone replied, "Your mushroom has a great place in our heart."
The farm was closed for about a year, but they eventually came up with a legal workaround with help from a Palestinian man living in Israel. Because he has Israeli citizenship, he can import the compost himself, then deliver it to Jericho as an Israeli company.
That was the solution. He has all the papers that
I'm sending this product from this company to that company.
This new method still involves some risk, but Amora was able to get back on its feet again last spring. Though the guys are happy to once again be feeding mushroom-loving Palestinians, they're pragmatic about compromises they have to make. Back at the farm, I point something out to Mahmoud.
So I see, like, those labels on the walls have, like, Hebrew writing on them?
Right. This structure comes from Israel. This structure. So again, we don't have a company that produces these panels. Unfortunately, in Palestine, we don't have the capacity to produce those, yeah?
Mahmoud tells me it's sort of impossible to completely cut out Israel.
At the end of the day, what the electricity that we use to run this farm comes from Israel. But again, can you substitute things or you cannot? This is the issue.
I ask Samir where he draws the line for himself.
You could imagine a moving line. I feel I have the privilege to draw it and to erase it as I see it suitable and necessary.
Samir uses Israeli medicine and even has guilty pleasure Israeli snack foods like bamba, the peanut butter version of Cheetos. He simply can't draw a single line separating himself from the Israeli economy, no matter how much he may want to.
And one more question. Do you think of yourself as someone who is boycotting Israel?
Can I answer that question by a question?
Sure.
Yeah, okay. Can you interact in a normal way with someone who beats you, harass you on a daily basis? No, you can't. So for me, it is beyond boycotting.
For Samir, it's about the act of creating, about building a Palestinian economy rather than supporting an Israeli one.
That was reporter Shayna Sheely. People who boycott Israel and the people who boycotted white businesses in Port Gibson, Mississippi, really everyone who takes part in a boycott today, they owe a debt to a 19th century Catholic priest in rural Ireland, the man who coined the word boycott.
And in the future, if any man offends against the community, you can ostracize him. You can isolate him. You can boycott him.
That story is coming out Wednesday, April 3rd on this podcast. Do not miss it. That means, you know, just go ahead and subscribe. Make it official. Jen Sheehan edited this week's show. Our lead producer was Stan Alcorn. Thanks also to Oye for the Supreme Court archival audio. Also, thanks to Ramya Krishnan, Maria LaHood, Emily Crosby, and Brian Casey. Our production manager is Najib Amini. Our sound design team is the dynamic duo, Jay Breezy, Mr. Jim Briggs, and Fernando, my man, Yo Aruda. They had help this week from Catherine Raimondo and Caitlin Benz. Our CEO is Krista Scharfenberg. Matt Thompson is our editor-in-chief. Our executive producer is Kevin Sullivan. Our theme music is by Camarado, Lightning. Support for Reveal is provided by the Reva and David Logan Foundation, the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, the Jonathan Logan Family Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the Heising Simons Foundation, and the Ethics and Excellence in Journalism Foundation. Reveal is a co-production of the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX. I'm Al Edson. And remember, there is always more to the story.